Deuteronomy, which we are going through in our morning worship, and we've come this morning to chapter 10, one of the great chapters of the Old Testament, and which we'll need to take in two studies. Deuteronomy chapter 10 and verse 1, "At that time the Lord said to me, 'Hew two tablets of stone, like the first, and come up to me on the mountain and make an ark of wood. And I will write on the tablets the words which were on the first tablets which you broke, and you shall put them inside the ark.' And so I made an ark of acacia wood and hewed two tablets of stone like the first, and went up the mountain with the two tablets in my hand. And God wrote on the tablets, as at the first writing, the Ten Commandments, which the Lord had spoken to you on the mountain out of the midst of the fire on the day of the assembly. And the Lord gave them to me. Then I turned and came down from the mountain, and I put the tablets inside the ark which I had made, and there they are, as the Lord commanded me. The people of Israel journeyed from Be'eroth, Bene Ya'akan, to Mosherah, and there Aaron died, and there he was buried. And his son Eleazar ministered as priest in his stead. From there they journeyed to Gudgoda, and from Gudgoda to Jotbatha, a land with brooks of water. At that time the Lord set apart the tribe of Levi to carry the ark of the covenant of the Lord, to stand before the Lord, to minister to him, and to bless in his name to this day. And therefore Levi has no portion or inheritance with his brothers. He wasn't allowed to own lands and houses. Levi has no portion or inheritance with his brothers. The Lord is his inheritance, as the Lord your God said to him. I stayed on the mountain, as at the first time, 40 days and 40 nights, and the Lord hearkened to me that time also. He was praying. The Lord was unwilling to destroy you. And the Lord said to me, 'Arise, go on your journey at the head of the people, that they may go in and possess the land which I swore to their fathers to give them.' And now, Israel, what's your response to all of that? What does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments and statutes of the Lord, which I command you this day for your good? Behold, to the Lord your God belong heaven and the heaven of heavens, the earth with all that is in it. And yet this Lord set his heart in love upon your fathers and chose their descendants after them, you above all peoples, as at this day. Circumcise therefore your hearts and be no longer stubborn. For the Lord your God is God above gods, and Lord above lords, the great, the mighty, and the terrible God, who is not partial and takes no bribe. He executes justice for the fatherless and the widow, and loves the sojourner, giving him food and clothing. Love the sojourner, therefore, for you once were sojourners in the land of Egypt. You shall fear the Lord your God. You shall serve him and cleave to him. And by his name you shall swear, he is your praise. He is your God who has done for you these great and terrible things which your eyes have seen. Why? Your fathers went down into Egypt, 70 persons. And now the Lord your God has made you like the stars of heaven for multitude. Amen. May the Lord add a blessing to the reading of his word. To his name be the honor and the praise. I don't know how it is with you, but have you ever felt, as you come to certain chapters of the Bible, that your imagination is being stretched to its limits? That certainly is the feeling one has in coming to this monumental 10th chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. It's one of the greatest chapters in the Old Testament, and it is a chapter that is filled with superlatives. For example, in verse 12, we read about the highest that God requires from man. What does the Lord require of you in answer to his goodness towards you and his grace showered on you? What does the Lord require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments and the statutes of the Lord, to fear, to walk, to love, to serve, to keep. These are the things that God requires of you in response to his grace. And that, what does the Lord require of you in Deuteronomy 10, is a superlative study in itself. And in fact, it could be set alongside the other what does the Lord require of yous that you find in the Bible. For example, the prophet Malachi takes up the same question. What does the Lord require of you? And the answer he gives, of course, is in the famous words, but to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. A complete summary of practical religion. Doing justly, loving mercy, and walking humbly with your God. And this is what God requires of you. It is a question of duty. It's an idea that's also taken up by the preacher in Ecclesiastes. The word Ecclesiastes simply means the preacher. And there in chapter 3 and verse 15 of Ecclesiastes, the preacher also speaks about something that God requires. And he says, God requires that which is past. The lost years, the undone years, all the madness and the folly of your past sins, the guilt and the shame that dog our lives. God requires that which is past. As I say, it's a study in itself. And here in Deuteronomy 10 is the superlative requirement of God from his creatures. In practical religion, we are to fear, to walk, to love, to serve, and to keep. And that is a neat summary of all that God expects from us. You also find a superlative in verse 14, where we read, "Behold, to the Lord your God belong heaven and the heaven of heavens." Not just the stars and the planets and the galaxies and the nebulae of outer space as we know them, but the heaven of heavens belongs to God. Highest heaven, as we would say. Compare that with the Song of Songs, meaning the highest and the greatest and the best song of all. The heaven of heavens is the highest and the greatest and the best heaven of all. It is superlative heaven, and it belongs to God. You find another superlative in verse 17 of this chapter, where we read, "The Lord your God is God above gods and Lord above lords." The great and mighty and terrible God, who is not partial and takes no bribe. Now, the point about that latter description of God as a God who is not partial and takes no bribe is that in that world, pagans thought that the gods were bribable. You could offer something to them that would move them to give you what you wanted them to give you. In other words, the gods could be corrupted by gifts if you brought the right kind of gift and in the right kind of way. You could bribe God to give you what you wanted him to give you. And the pagans used to believe that if you prayed long enough, or if you prayed loud enough, or if you sang vociferously enough, or if you howled lustily enough, or if you went in for vain repetitions, or if you cut yourself with lancets, or if you handed over your firstborn child as a sacrifice, then in response to all of this bribery, God would listen to you. You could buy God. You could buy his favors. You could buy his grace. The gods were bribable. But over against all of that, there stood the true and the living God. And he was not partial and took no bribe, because he was the superlative God. He was the incorruptible God. He was above bribery. He was a superlative God who was God above gods and Lord above lords. A superlative. You find yet another superlative in verse 21, where we read, "He is your praise, and he is your God." Not as if God was away up there, and our praise was away down here, and we brought our praise to God. It's not as if God was there, and your praise was here. He is your praise. That's what God is. He is the best that your heart can desire. He is the highest that your heart can long for. He is the sweetest that your soul can taste. And in himself, God is your praise and your God. A superlative God. And again, the superlative occurs in the very last verse of this chapter, where God is portrayed as the God who took 70 and made from that 70 a nation as the stars of the heaven for multitude. Your fathers went down to Egypt 70 persons, and now the Lord your God, this superlative God, has made you as the stars of heaven for multitude. And so there really are two immense themes in this chapter, and I'd like to take two Sunday mornings to think of them. The first theme is the greatness of God in heaven above. And the second theme, which we'll study in the future, the greatness of God's love on earth below. Let's think then, first of all, of God's greatness in heaven above, looking particularly at verses 14, 17, and 21. To the Lord your God belong heaven and the heaven of heavens. He is God above gods and Lord above lords. He is your praise and your God. The background to these words is the ancient belief that gods were tribal gods. They were very local gods, and they were limited in their power. That was how the pagans used to think about God in that world. The power of the gods was limited by territory and by geography. And once you went outside the god's territory, you moved into the territory of another god. For example, if this held true today, there would be one god who looked after Inverness. There would be another god who looked after Nairn. And Elgin would have its own god, and so would Aberdeen. And as you travelled from Inverness to Nairn, you would move outside the influence of the god of Inverness, and you would come under the influence of the god of Nairn. And if you drove through Nairn and into Elgin, you would come under the influence of Elgin's god. And if you spent the day in Aberdeen, during that day in Aberdeen, you would be under the influence of Aberdeen's god. And that was how the pagans used to think about the gods. Once you were beyond the territory, you were beyond the influence and the power of the god. And Israel had to learn this lesson over and over again, that her god was not like these other gods, hedged in by geography and circumscribed and limited. Israel's God was everywhere. And where you went, he went. That's the point of the great promise in the Old Testament. I will go with you.
I will be with you. Through the sea. Doesn't matter what the geography is. Through the sea, through the wilderness, through the Jordan, in the land. Wherever you go, I will go. I will be with you. And wherever you are, and in whatever circumstances you find yourself, I will be with you. Now, that was foreign to the pagan mind. Of course, today as Christians, we take that kind of promise for granted. I will never leave you nor forsake you, says Christ. I will be with you to the end of the age. And these are very comforting and reassuring and encouraging words for a Christian. But originally, they had quite a specific meaning and purpose. They were there to assure the children of God that their God was a big God, not a tribal God, not a local divinity. I will be with you wherever you are. And in her worst moments, Israel was tempted to forget that whatever the geography, God was with her, just as in our worst moments. And in our worst geographies, we are tempted as Christians to forget it. The Jews used to sing in Babylon, you know. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? Have you ever asked that question? When you felt yourself down and out, and all washed out, and a failure as a Christian, and spiritually exhausted and depressed, when you were at the end of your tether in some kind of Babylon, when you were going through a Babylon experience, have you ever asked yourself that question? How can I sing the Lord's song in this strange land? You see, the Jews asked that question because they had forgotten that God is not a tribal God. They were prisoners in Babylon at the time, and the Jews knew perfectly well that Babylon, well, that was the land of other gods. That was their geography. Bel and Nebo and Ishtar and Marduk, they were the gods of Babylon, and that is where they operated. But Jehovah didn't work in Babylon. He worked in Palestine. Babylon was not his sphere of operations. He didn't work there. And so they sang, how shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land, in a foreign geography? Are you in a foreign land this morning? Are you in a strange geography this morning? Do you feel down and out and cast off and exhausted and depressed? Well, you can sing the Lord's song in a strange land, because God says, whatever your geography, I will be with you. The God above gods, the Lord above lords, to whom belong the heaven and the heaven of heavens, superlative heaven, the God who is your praise and your God, I will be with you in Babylon. That surely was at the heart of Isaiah's message and Isaiah's greatness. You see, even in his day, people thought that God was a little God, just like the other gods. But Isaiah had a vision of the greatness of God, whose universal sway covered the earth and whose kingdom was an everlasting kingdom. That is why Isaiah said, God says in Isaiah, look unto me, all ye ends of the earth, and be ye saved. Not just the borders of Palestine, but look unto me, all ye ends of the earth, and be saved. He's a great God. The greatness of the God we serve in heaven above. Oh, my friends, do you doubt that this is the sort of evangelical vision that Christians need today? With so many churches on the verge of extinction, our presbytery has been told to close 2 churches by the end of the 1980s. Do you not think that this is the sort of evangelical vision of God that Christians need with our society in its death throes, while churchmen argue about nonsense such as the motherhood of God? Don't you think Christians need this evangelical vision when what Os Guinness calls the dust of death lies thick on Western Christendom? And don't you think that that sort of evangelical vision of God would revive and revitalize your own Christian profession? Dag Hammarskjöld, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, a Christian man, put it like this before his tragic death in that sinister plane crash in Africa. We die on the day when our lives cease to be illumined by the steady radiance renewed daily of a wonder, the source of which is beyond reason. A wonder, the source of which is beyond reason. It is the good news of the gospel that that wonder beyond reason has broken through to sinner man marvelously and savingly in the person of Jesus Christ. And in Jesus Christ, this great and mighty God makes himself known to you and says to you this morning, here's the invitation. Please think big thoughts about me. I am your God. I will be with you. I will go with you. I will never let you go. Now, you lay hold on me and make me, this great God, your own. The God to whom heaven and the heaven of heavens belong. The God above gods, the light above lights. The great, the mighty, the terrible God. The God who can take 70 and out of the 70 build a nation as many as the stars of the heaven for number. The God who is your praise and your God. Think big thoughts about me. Make me your own, says this God, and all will be well. Amen. May the Lord bless his word to our hearts. To his name be honor and praise. Now we sing the first and the last verses of hymn number 29 as we come to the baptism. Hymn number 29,
the first and the last verses only, "Now thank we all our God."